On this week's 51%.
And liftoff.
When you look at the Earth with your own eyes from that vantage point, you're almost in disbelief that we exist in the blackness of space.
Our associate producer Jody Cowan catches up with NASA astronaut, engineer, and chemist Tracy Caldwell Dyson ahead of her third trip to the ISS this month. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You are listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. Today we've got our eyes on the sky. I didn't necessarily plan it this way, but we've got a lineup of space-themed stories and interviews for you. I think it's worth pointing out that while women are greatly outnumbered by men in space travel and the STEM fields around it, they have been involved in space travel since its early days. Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman to orbit the Earth in 1963, just 2 years after Yuri Gagarin. This month, NASA's Expedition 71 crew will embark on a six-month mission aboard the International Space Station to continue an array of scientific experiments aimed at helping humans further understand space and boost our health here on Earth. Participating in that mission as part of her third space flight and second long-term stay aboard the ISS is NASA astronaut Tracy Caldwell Dyson. A California native with a PhD in chemistry, Dyson was first selected as an astronaut in 1998 and has logged more than 188 days in space, racking up numerous awards for her role as both a mission specialist and flight engineer, supporting technological advancements at the ISS in 2007 and 2010. During her missions, she's also helped film videos for viewers back home to understand what life on the ISS is like and why these experiments are important. On March 21st, Dyson is expected to launch aboard a Russia-based Roscosmos-Soyuz MS-25 spacecraft with astronauts from Russia and Belarus. Before the launch, Dyson spoke with our associate producer, Jody Cowan.
The major role of our expedition is to continue doing the science and supporting the station in maintenance and upgrades. And my particular role is to serve on board in the capacity of engineer, scientist, as well as the hands-on wrench monkey when something breaks and I need to help fix it. I was just talking about the flame experiment, SOFI, that's going to be conducted in the SIR rack. And that just gets at mechanisms and physical properties of flames in space, which really interests me. There's also, we have a levitation furnace in experiment that's going on in the Japanese module. I was trained on that while I was out at scuba training there, and I'm really looking forward to those experiments. There's also a really cool experiment that combines biology and EVA. It's called ISS External Microorganisms. And so it's where we go EVA with a swab box, and we basically give the space station a COVID test, and we test areas where the environmental control system basically vents to the outside just to see what kind of microbes may be carried outside and transported. And that has all sorts of application for not only spacecraft design, but just understanding what can survive in a harsh environment like space. I'm a subject for a number of human research projects. And so I'll be donating bodily fluids and my brain waves and heart rate and pressure stats and all sorts of things like that. So there's just a whole host of things I'm looking forward to participating in, either as a subject or as the operator.
This is your third visit to the International Space Station, the last time being in 2010. How has the ISS itself been updated since your last stay?
Oh, gosh, a lot. It's been about 14 years since I've been there. And everything from how we view our timeline and interact with it to just the philosophy of how we get through scheduled activities on board and just making certain activities flexible for astronauts to do at particular times of the day that are most convenient for them, as opposed to a rigid timeline. It may seem like a small thing, but it's a really big deal on board to make things efficient. And that's, I think, the primary change from when I was there before. When I was there before, it was the transition between building the space station to utilizing it. And now that we've been utilizing it for over a decade, our operations have become quite efficient, and I'm really looking forward to experiencing that new paradigm.
As part of the Expedition 71 crew, you are launching with the Russian Roscosmos Soyuz MS-25 spacecraft and joining the SpaceX Dragon 8 crew, who will be launching a couple of weeks ahead of you. What are some of the major differences in training or technology between the two traveling space forces?
Oh, wow. We're going to need a lot of time to go through all of that. But I would say, obviously, language is one. So on the Soyuz, the primary language is, and the sole language is Russian. And so we speak that, we read that, everything's in Russian. So that's one of the biggest differences. The other is that I spend a great deal of time here in Russia doing the training, as opposed to have I had launched on a SpaceX, where I would spend a lot more time in Houston. Technology-wise, they're both automated, the vehicles, to some large extent, but the Soyuz does have some manual capability that if something were to not look right with the automated system, we would down mode to that. I like to say about the Soyuz that it's a tried and true, attested vehicle, and one of its strengths is in its robustness. It's straightforward philosophy on how to fly a capsule. And so because of some of those things, as a crew member, it's really rewarding to study the systems and to interact with them and to be part of the crew on board those systems.
You have a 6-month stay on the ISS ahead of you. How do you personally prepare for such a stay, mentally and physically, and how do you make it feel like home?
A lot of prayer goes into it. I've got a fantastic support system at home, and my husband reminds me all the time that I'm doing this as much for him as I am for myself. And so that goes a long way towards keeping me focused on the job that I have at hand. I've done this before. And the benefit of that is knowing what I need to focus on and what I don't need to focus on. And that helps me to just adds extra peace going into it that perhaps on my first flight I didn't have.
I know you're a fan of space media, consulting on films like The Martian and filming your own station life show for NASA TV during the last ISS mission. Can we expect more from you in front of or behind the camera for this mission?
Well, there might be a little bit of station life going on board. We'll see how things work out. You know, there's a lot of work to do, so those kinds of activities and projects take a little time, but I know that myself and my crewmates on the SpaceX side are looking forward to some downtime filming that, so we hope that that works out. I do have music that I love to listen to, and I've got my playlist, everything from soothing Enya to some Christian artists that I really enjoy. I'll probably be keeping my tunes to myself, though. Don't want to disturb anybody.
You've mentioned it a few times, and I just know your faith is something that's very important to you. How, if at all, has your concept of faith and your belief in God evolved with the time you spent above the clouds?
You know, I think most of my my faith has grown more in my life on the earth. And it's because of that that I look forward to taking that strength with me up in orbit and serving others with it. But when I'm looking at the Earth from the vantage point of the space station, it just reminds me of how incredible our Creator is. And when you look at the Earth with your own eyes from that vantage point, you're almost in disbelief that we exist in the blackness of space. And it makes me appreciate my faith even more.
You've taken arguably the coolest and most iconic selfie in the known universe. For those unfamiliar, can you tell us more about the cupola and why it's your favorite room on the ISS?
The cupola is our bay window. It's our view of home and that gorgeous planet. And let me tell you, when you look outside the cupola, whether you're looking at the Earth, whether you're looking at the universe, whether you're looking at the miraculous structure of the space station, there is always something new to see and something that just puts you in complete awe of where you are and what you get to do. And I was getting ready to come back home, and my psych doc said, "What are you going to miss the most up there?" And I said, "That cupola." and the view from it. And they said, well, you need to take a picture. And so then I worked for about 3 weeks on setting up the camera and myself and the remote control to operate the shutter and just get the most perfect lighting. And what I was going for was an image that reminded me whenever I looked at it of what it felt like to look out the window. And in the raw photo that was actually the one that I sent down to the ground, the exposure was set for the earth and not necessarily so that you could see me. And that was so that I could just see the silhouette of me. And the recreations of that photo have actually overexposed me in the photo. So you can see that it's me. But nevertheless, you can still see that beautiful planet and what that cupola provides for us in terms of a window to it. And it was when I sent the photo actually to my photo TV instructor, Steve Berenswig, and I just wanted to show him that I thought I got the right lighting and everything. And then my crewmate, Doug Wheelock, saw this photo and he said, hey, TC, can I tweet that? And I was like, oh, I guess, sure. And that's how it got out into the internet. And so that's the backstory behind the cupola shot.
Thank you again for your time, Tracy. Safe travels and the best of luck to you on your journey and mission.
Thanks a lot, Jody. It's nice talking to you.
That was NASA astronaut and chemist Tracy Caldwell Dyson speaking with our associate producer, Jody Cowan. She's set to launch on a Russian spacecraft for her third mission to the International Space Station on March 21st. Meantime, we have an update on another astronaut that we recently featured on this show. Last month, we brought you a quick story on NASA astronaut Jeanette Epps, who was slated to embark on her first trip to the ISS as part of the SpaceX Crew 8 mission aimed at helping NASA better understand long-term space travel. A little over a week ago, after a couple delays due to bad weather, Epps and the rest of the four-person crew finally took off from Kennedy Space Center in Florida aboard a SpaceX Dragon spacecraft.
3, 2, 1, ignition. Engines full power, and liftoff of NASA Crew 8. Go Falcon, go SpaceX, and go NASA.
One alpha.
Endeavor ascends, a beacon of human ambition. 1.7 million pounds of thrust now propelling Falcon 9 and Crew 8. Vehicle is pitching downrange.
According to NASA, Epps joins a total of 75 women who have flown in space so far. Again, Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova was the first in 1963. It would be another 20 years before NASA astronaut Sally Ride became the first American woman in space, with a 7-day stint on the Shuttle Challenger. But since then, it's been milestone after milestone. Soviet astronaut Svetlana Savitskaya was the first woman to participate in a spacewalk in 1984. NASA astronaut Shannon Lucid set a record for the longest single flight by a woman with a 188-day mission on the Russian space station Mir in 1996. And NASA's Pamela Melroy became the first female pilot of a shuttle flight to a space station in 2000. She'd go on two more trips over the next decade. Now that Epps is up at the ISS, she will spend the next 6 months contributing to experiments analyzing the long-term effects of space travel on humans, as NASA works to one day put the first woman and person of color on the moon, and even toys with the idea of missions to Mars. First and foremost, though, as a mission specialist for Crew 8, Epps' main jobs are to monitor the spacecraft during launch and reentry. Their launch into orbit was a success, and they have since docked onto the ISS. Epps, a 53-year-old engineer from Syracuse, New York, made sure to give her hometown a shout-out on the way up.
I'm super excited to be here, and I am in a New York state of mind right now. It is amazing. Thank you for everything.
Back on Earth, specifically New York's Hudson Valley, Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies is launching a new summer STEM program aimed at helping middle and high school teachers incorporate lessons on ecology and climate change into their curriculums. The Institute in Millbrook, New York, recently received a 3-year award from the National Science Foundation as part of its Research Experience for Teachers, Sites, and Biological Sciences, or BioRETS, program. A total of 9 teachers from across the county will receive a stipend to spend 6 weeks researching alongside scientists at Cary Institute on the condition that they put what they learn toward lessons and projects for their students. Cary Institute says it plans to prioritize teachers from underrepresented groups in STEM, including women. I recently spoke with program coordinator Rebecca Van Tassel for a preview.
There's not a lot of other professional learning experiences that are like this for teachers, that we're building our program around the belief and the reality that teachers are intellectuals and that there's a lot that goes into being an effective teacher. It's not just what you know about your content, but it's about your ability to build relationships with kids and navigate this complex environment in the classroom. And so this program really honors the knowledge and skills and abilities that teachers already bring to the table at our program, and to really heighten and leverage that knowledge that teachers hold that nobody else knows about their profession and their kids. And so we're a very teacher-friendly environment, and we're here to elevate teachers' intellect. The summer is 6 weeks of full-time research, starting July 1st through August 13th. And during that 6 weeks of time, we'll have a cohort of 9 teachers working in 3 collaborative teams with research scientists here at Cary. And they will jump in on ongoing research that's happening with those research mentors, learn about how those research projects are structured and how the data collection happens, what the data analysis looks like, and conduct some of their own original research here in those collaborative teams. And while they do that work, they'll also be thinking about how they're going to bring this back to their classroom, to their students. And so working with our education team to develop new curriculum resources that they can then take their classroom. So the experience doesn't end after the summer is over. We'll have follow-up meetings during the school year with teachers to support them in implementing their new classroom materials, and then bring them back together in person next to June for a writing retreat, where we'll take some time away from everything else to really focus on telling the story of what they've learned and how they've implemented it so that they can publish their knowledge.
What are some of the different things that they might be looking at?
Well, that's a great question. So they'll be jumping into ongoing research that's happening at Cary. So it's not a completely open-ended research experience. They'll be guided by our research mentors. So our research mentors this summer will be doing work on microbial communities and soils and how they're affected by climate change. They'll be doing research on nitrogen in the soils. And so lots of soil focus, but also some other terrestrial ecology topics.
Is this something that's mainly for teachers who are already teaching science and biology and stuff like that, or is this open to teachers who are teaching other subjects as well?
Yeah, we really want to build interdisciplinary teams in our research teams, and so we're welcoming middle and high school teachers from who are teaching in math classrooms, who might be teaching computer science, and any of the science disciplines, so physics teachers or biology teachers or chemistry teachers. I know a lot of our local schools are working on developing curriculum that's based in project-based learning, and this type of experience could really help teachers who want to do that type of work, because if you're a math teacher and you want to do a project, you need the project to be about something, and so why not have it be ecology? It's something that teachers can make relevant no matter where they are, right in their own schoolyards.
This is a national program, right?
It is a national program. We're hoping for a combination of local teachers from our local school districts and teachers from out of area. And if teachers are from out of area, we're able to offer travel and housing so that they can actually stay here on our campus in the summertime.
And when it comes to, I guess, like then taking this research and translating it into their curriculums, what are some ways that you imagine they might be able to do that?
I think there's lots of different ways that teachers can do that. They could take the content that they're learning directly if they have a way to integrate that meaningfully into their classroom, or they can take what they're learning about science practices and the ways that we do science and translate that into our classrooms. New York State science standards and the national standards emphasize this three-dimensional learning where you're taking the content that students are learning, you're taking the ways that science is done, these science practices, and these thematic elements that link all of the content together and to create three-dimensional learning experiences for students. And so our teachers will be having an authentic three-dimensional learning experience and will be helping them build materials that do that for their students too.
Rebecca Van Tassel is the program coordinator for Cary Institute's Summer BioRets program, helping high school teachers incorporate lessons on climate change and ecology in the classroom. To learn more, you can go to caryinstitute.org. Our last guest has been writing about science for NPR since about 2005. As the organization's science correspondent, Nell Greenfield Boyce has covered stories from the end of NASA's space shuttle program to natural disasters and the biology behind many animal behaviors. Greenfield Boyce says she's particularly interested in stories that demonstrate how science and technology connects with people and culture. It's an approach she carries into her new book called Transient and Strange: Notes on the Science of Life. In it, Greenfield Boyce asks the big questions, like, are fleas as interesting as whales? And how likely are you to pass down kidney disease? She also weaves in her experiences of adolescence, marriage, and motherhood. WAMC News Director Ian Pickus recently spoke with Greenfield Boyce to learn more.
I always loved science as a kid and, you know, just mucking around outside and like encountering, you know, toads and little insects and plants. I was always curious and I thought I was going to be a scientist. And when I went to college, I took, you know, biology courses and chemistry, but I also took history of science courses. And I got fascinated with science as a sort of social activity and learning about how we came to know everything we know. And at some point, I realized, like, all the stuff that I enjoyed as a kid, like watching documentaries and reading popular science, that there was actually a job which involved making those things. And so I've been doing that ever since. And I feel like I really lucked out. It's an awesome career. And it gets me to study interesting things all the time.
Did seeing things through your kids' eyes reawaken something in how you approach science and what you were just talking about?
I think so, because kids, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but kids are kind of scientists themselves. They're, you know, fearless in probing, you know, whatever new thing they encounter, and they have no preconceptions, and they're incredibly, you know, serious and dedicated to just trying to figure everything out. And that includes some real big philosophical questions about, you know, death and the universe and what it all means, you know, the kind of questions that as an adult you can sort of, you know, stop thinking about and maybe focus on the day-to-day. But when your kids are right there, you know, sort of looking to you for guidance, suddenly you are reminded that, oh yeah, like all this stuff is out there to be grappled with.
I'm dying to know, how come your kids call you Nell?
You know, it's a funny thing. I grew up calling my mother Susie, and people would ask me, like, is she your real mother? And obviously she is, but it's my brother, when he was growing up, one day just asked her, like, what's your name? And she told him. And so he started calling her that, and I started calling him that too, because he was my older brother. And when my kids were very young, they called me, you know, Mama, and I kind of liked it. It was cool. But then at some point, they just started calling me Nell too. So I don't know. I'm not sure what it means, but I just, well, what can I say? It's my name.
Let me ask you a personal question, because the last part of your book is about how hard you and your husband really had to work to have children. And that a lot of times, you know, you're questioning the path, you're questioning your choices. How did you get convinced? You know, how did you know that that was something you really wanted?
Having children or going mm-hmm. through a sort of genetic
Well, I guess both
process.
In a way.
Well, I don't know if I ever questioned that I wanted children. They seem like awesome fun, and indeed they have been. But for me, you know, my husband's family has a genetic kidney disease. And so we were faced with whether or not we wanted to try to do anything to try to avoid passing that down. And so it sort of thrust us into a whole world of medical decision making that, for me, as somebody who's very aware of the history of science and the history of genetics, and in particular, the really dark history of eugenics that existed in this country, it really made me think about the whole process, I think, in a pretty complicated way. And it certainly set me off on a series of events and decisions that, were difficult at the time. And you know, I tried to write about it all pretty frankly, because I feel like, yeah, it's personal, but at the same time, people are having to deal with this stuff. And not everybody talks about it. And I thought, well, here I could talk about it and also put it in some historical context.
How's everybody doing now?
As far as I know, we're great.
That's good. My colleague here at the station has a saying that a version of me is on the radio. And so it occurs to me that your book is a lot more revealing than you normally are, you know, in your stories. How did you decide to open the door a little bit?
You know, I've always been kind of a private person, especially, you know, as a journalist, you want to maintain a sort of reserve. You want, you know, what you're reporting on to be the story, not you. But I've always done more personal writing, whether it's letters to friends or other things. And when I started writing these essays, I found myself writing about things that were rather personal. And, you know, I kind of surprised myself in that I don't mind. I don't really care. I thought I would care more than I did, that other people would hear about this stuff. But to me, everything in the book is kind of an everyday, ordinary experience that people have. And the only difference is that I have spent my whole career and really much of my life thinking about science. And so, you know, all the poetry and the metaphors and the ways I have of trying to understand it involve science, you know. So when I write about, you know, my first kiss, it was a weird situation, but it was also mixed up with black holes. And, you know, sort of that's an example of how, like, for me, in a way, it's revealing because it's personal. But in another way, these are pretty universal experiences, I think.
So a lot of science reporting in recent years is pretty grim. You know, it's new diseases, climate change, that kind of thing. How do you go about retaining your sense of awe and openness, given the fact that so much of it is negative?
There is a lot of grimness in the world, and, you know, you don't want to hide from that. And in fact, you know, that's one of the things I explore in this book is, like, you know, when you're a parent, you have to tell your children about so much that's so difficult, like nuclear war, like nuclear weapons. It's like, yeah, as an adult, you can sort of pretend they don't exist. But when your kids start asking you questions, you have to give them answers. But at the same time, there is so much beauty in the world, and there are so many people working hard to make discoveries and do things. And, you know, as I report on them, people are excited and people are thrilled to know that somebody's out there trying to figure out exactly what color Neptune is, for example, you know, or exactly how something evolved or how it came to be or what's going on with Venus. And, you know, what about those black holes? I think that it makes people feel hopeful. You know, hopeful that we're figuring things out and that we're all doing it together as humanity.
I'm glad you brought up space because it's such an interesting time. A lot of your coverage has been on space exploration and NASA. And I just wonder what you make of this moment we're in, where so much of the effort to get back out there is being done by, you know, private enterprise and billionaires as much as the government.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, NASA is trying to do something different. And it's trying to, you know, make a more sustainable situation where it's not just one government agency doing things, but, you know, integrate it more into an industrial base and economic activity. And, you know, we'll see how that goes. I mean, you know, obviously there are differences between NASA and the private sector. And, you know, people have different feelings about this. And I think that, you know, it's kind of an experiment. It's kind of a new way of trying to do things. And as it's happening, you know, we're seeing all the pros and cons playing out.
I know it's probably cost prohibitive for now, but would you go up?
Would I go to space?
If you had the chance? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely not. Never.
Me neither. Okay, honesty question. Are you doodling as we do this interview?
I have a pen in my hand right now. I'm not actually doodling because I'm in the studio and I wouldn't want the scratching to get picked up by the microphone. But there are papers in front of me with geometric doodles, yes, that I have done in between interviews. Mm-hmm.
So writing about it didn't end the fixation?
No. So I have a whole essay in the book about my compulsive geometric doodling. And that is so much a part of me, I don't think it could ever go away. It's almost essential to the working of my brain, which is, you know, what I was trying to write about in the essay, is trying to understand, like, what's going on there? And, like, how does it connect with the history of science? And why do so many people doodle in the same ways? And why do we doodle? I mean, there's a appalling lack of scientific research on this. So if some potential PhD candidate is listening, there's a whole world that could be studied there.
As you noted, your doodling puts you in good company, so I guess don't stop.
Well, as the title of the essay is, everybody does it.
That was NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield Boyce speaking with WAMC's Ian Pickus about her new book, Transient and Strange, Notes on the Science of Life, out now through W.W. Norton & Company. You can find some of Nell's other work at npr.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.